I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. So what are you going to be doing this Monday afternoon at 1:21? That's when the partial eclipse of the sun will begin in Philadelphia. Now, we're not in the 70-mile-wide path of totality where people can experience a total solar eclipse, when for a few minutes the day will become night, the wind will change, the temperatures will drop, and animals and insects will think it is time for sleep. This year, the U.S. will witness a total solar eclipse that will cross the country, traveling from the West Coast to the East. This hasn't happened in 99 years. Today on the show, what to expect on Monday, how to view the eclipse safely, and what we hope to learn. We begin our conversation with Jay Pasikoff. He's an astronomer at Williams College. In fact, one of the world's leading eclipse astronomers, has experienced 65 solar eclipses. He joins us from Oregon, a front row seat to this exciting event. And Professor Pasikoff, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be with you this morning.
What's your first solar eclipse experience?
My first? Mm-hmm. Back when I was a freshman at Harvard, a professor took us up in a plane above Boston. It was cloudy below, and we had this fantastic view from above.
I read that you also saw one on your honeymoon. Is that true?
Well, it was a little bit of a delayed honeymoon. We were married in March. But there was an eclipse in June in Western Australia, so we did go to that, yes.
Help us understand. I think I do understand why this is such a big deal, but from your perspective, what's going to happen on Monday?
Well, what I will describe now is only in the band of totality, only in the 65-mile-wide band of totality that stretches from Oregon to through the middle of the country to South Carolina. And then it will essentially get a million times darker than it is on a normal day. The sun will be completely hidden by the moon, and because all that sunlight isn't hitting the Earth's atmosphere, the blue sky will go away, and that will reveal what's behind it, even today. The sun is surrounded by a tenuous glowing corona, as it's called, the crown of hot gas around the sun. And the only time we can see that whole best part of the corona is during a total solar eclipse. Mm-hmm. So we get a couple of minutes or a few minutes every year and a half somewhere in the world. And this time, it's our turn in the United States.
You're in Oregon. Are you there because essentially that's where the eclipse will begin in the continental U.S.?
I'm there because my colleague Jay Anderson, a meteorologist, did cloudiness statistics for August, going back to 20 years of satellite photographs, and color-coded them. And the best color code, the blue instead of the deep orange, is in the Pacific Northwest in Oregon and Idaho, whereas it's quite often thunderstormy and cloudy in the afternoon in South Carolina. So we chose to go where the cloudiness statistics were best.
Have you checked the weather forecast for Monday?
It's trending pretty good, and today is an absolutely perfect blue sky day, not a cloud in the sky. We had that 2 days ago. Yesterday it started cloudy and cleared up. But we're committed here with hundreds of people and tons of equipment and narrow roads. We're committed. We're going to do whatever we can.
What kind of equipment do you have out there?
Well, everything I could think of to bring for an American eclipse. I didn't have to take it through customs agents. So we have about 20 telescopes. We have about 25 cameras. We have telephoto lenses ranging up to over 1,000 millimeters. And then we have some delicate spectrographs and we have some particularly sensitive and fast cameras of special types. We have filters that pass uniquely the radiation from the corona. We have quite a lot of different kinds of equipment.
And the total eclipse that you're going to experience, how many minutes is that, do you anticipate?
It's just about 2 minutes here. So I chose to have 2 minutes in what I hope will be clear sky instead of going for 2 minutes and 40 seconds in what's predicted to be cloudy in southern Illinois. So we'll see. We'll know in a couple of days.
I read that you describe yourself as an eclipse preceder, not chaser. What's the difference?
Well, the shadow of the moon goes across the Earth at thousands of miles an hour, so you can't chase it. It's going too fast.
So you have to anticipate it, right?
Yes. So I'm here, and it's going to come to me. The moon's shadow is extending out in space. all the time. It's there now, and we are going to move into it on Monday.
So tell us how you're going to prepare for these 2 minutes on Monday. What are you going to do?
Well, I'm very fortunate to have written grant proposals that convinced the reviewers for the National Science Foundation and the National Geographic Society to fund our research. I have 8 students from Williams College and a number of colleagues from all over the world, my colleagues from Greece and from Slovakia arrived yesterday, plus some people from all over the United States. Graduate student David Slitsky from the University of Pennsylvania just arrived. We are set up at the campus of Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, especially some balconies and terraces in which we can restrict access for the safety and security of our equipment. And we're practicing, and we'll be ready.
So you'll be ready for those 2 minutes? Is that what you're practicing for?
Yes. Yes, we have sequences. In fact, there one of my students, Cielo Perez, has been programming a dozen Nikon DA10 cameras to be controlled by computers, by Apple computers. We've borrowed from Williams College and we just have to press something, click somewhere when totality begins, and the whole sequence is then automated on each of the cameras.
What are your suggestions for those of us that have never experienced what you're going to experience on Monday? We're amateurs, we're even maybe less than that, less even knowledgeable than an amateur.
You don't have to be knowledgeable at all to see a total eclipse.
I got it.
But the most amazing thing. So the main thing is, if you're in Philadelphia, get in your car and drive to some place where the eclipse is total. To be in a 70% eclipse or is like being 70% of the way to Disneyland.
It doesn't count, you're saying? It doesn't count?
It's not particularly interesting, in fact. So it doesn't hurt to go outside and look up through a filter. Sorry about that other phone.
Oh, that's okay. This is live radio. Things like this happen. You're a popular person, Jay Pasikoff, clearly.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
If you have one of these filters that cuts down the sun's light by a factor of a million, then it's safe to look up through them. If you just look under a tree, there'll probably be dappled light on the ground, which will have a crescent shape. That's called the pinhole camera effect. You can make a pinhole camera just by punching a little hole a quarter of an inch across on a piece of paper. And with the sun over your shoulder, looking away from the sun, you just project an image, and you'll see that the sun has a bite out of it, apparently, that the moon is covering it. So I will glance at that every 5 or 10 minutes just to see that the eclipse is happening, but it's not exciting at all. The exciting part is at the beginning and middle of the total eclipse, when it gets hundreds or 1,000 times darker within a minute, and the conditions change, as you mentioned before, wind, et cetera. We actually have a visiting Venezuelan atmospheric physicist. We're measuring all kinds of atmospheric parameters, temperature drops. It's just astounding to be outside and get the feeling of being outside in totality. But you have to be in totality to do it. The people who aren't in totality, they can look up and see that, and they won't understand why people think totality is so great.
Oh, interesting. Well, that's in part why you're on the show with us today. As you mentioned earlier, your specific interest, and I guess for a lot of people, is this corona. Obviously, when the sun is covered by the moon, we're going to see, or you're going to see something that's rare to see or not unusual to see. What do you hope to learn from that?
Well, the corona is part of the atmosphere of the sun. So basically, we're learning how the sun shines. The everyday surface that's up now, we understand pretty well. But we just get these rare looks at the higher levels. Energy is being put into them. The gas up in the corona is a couple of million degrees. Just exactly how it gets to be heated to such a high temperature above the surface of the sun, which is only about 10,000 degrees, is something that various people are doing research about. We have some conflicting models, ideas of how the sun's magnetic field leads to this high temperature. We're trying to understand magnetic fields. We're trying to understand the laws of magnetism in detail. There are big attempts to have nuclear fusion on Earth with hot gas held in place by magnetic fields, and we don't know how to do it well enough on Earth to restrain that gas for more than a tiny fraction of a second. The sun does it very well, and we're watching and learning. So we're learning about the sun and the billions and trillions of other stars like the sun, and also the basic laws of science that can help us on Earth.
What do you hope the rest of us can learn from a total eclipse of the sun?
Well, it can be especially inspiring to have kids outside and watch this phenomenon and realize that the scientists have predicted it and understand in general what's going on. And it can really inspire people to go on with their studies of all kinds. Scientifically, we're learning to improve our models of the magnetic field to predict when there could be storms that come and hit the Earth and zap satellites and cause surges on power lines. We're basically learning how the sun and the stars shine in detail.
Do we know when the next total solar eclipse will cross the continental United States?
Yes, as a matter of fact, they're not especially rare. I'm going to one in Chile in less than 2 years, July 2nd, 2019, and Argentina, December 2020. But in the United States, there's going to be a total solar eclipse whose path comes from Mexico, goes from Texas, with Dallas and San Antonio and Austin in totality, across Cleveland and Buffalo and Plattsburgh, New York, and northern Vermont and Maine in 2024, April 8th, 2024, so only about 6.5 years away.
So what will you be doing Sunday night?
We'll see how late we have to stay up with the last bits of apparatus. We're just about to go over to resume on our apparatus now. Some scientists, but also a bunch of eclipse tourists who've traveled with me and traveled with my travel agent for a bunch of eclipses. When people see one eclipse, they want to see more, so this eclipse tourism has been growing. So we'll have a dinner, I know, Sunday night, and I'll be giving a little lecture, and we have experts on viewing eclipse safely. And the sunspot cycle, a NASA scientist on the sunspot cycle, we're at a minimum of the sunspot cycle now. So we'll be doing that and preparing our apparatus. My daughter from California just sent me the most ridiculous note I've ever seen about somebody saying, keep your pets inside or they could go blind on Monday afternoon. And, I mean, it even had the time wrong. But there's nothing hazardous that happens during an eclipse. Pets, animals are going to be fine. People are going to be fine. It's just sad for us to see so much misinformation going around. The task force of the American Astronomical Society on solar eclipses has worked with the American Medical Association, American Ophthalmological Association.
Got to say goodbye. I appreciate you joining us. I appreciate your enthusiasm and all this good information. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I just said goodbye to Jay Pasikoff, an astronomer at Williams College. He joined us in Oregon, and that is the beginning of the solar eclipse that's going to happen on Monday. We're getting ready for Monday's total solar eclipse, and this is a 70-mile-wide path of darkness when the moon passes between the Earth and the sun. It will begin in Oregon in the morning and in South Carolina by mid-afternoon. Now, we're not in the direct path here in the Philadelphia area, so we will enjoy a partial eclipse, no matter what Jay Pasikoff says, and that's not too shabby. I checked the weather forecast, and it looks like clear skies. There's a lot of excitement in scientific circles about what can be learned from this unusual event, and certainly excitement among the public, including a run on eclipse eyeglasses, as well as invitations to eclipse parties. Join our conversation. Call us at 1-888-477-9499 with any eclipse-related questions. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Dave Goldberg is sitting across from me here in our Philadelphia studio, professor of physics, associate dean at Drexel University's College of Arts and Sciences. He's an astrophysicist, author of The User's Guide to the Universe and The Universe in the Rearview Mirror. Dave Goldberg, Goldberg. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone is Derek Pitts, Chief Astronomer and Planetarium Director at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, also WHYY's resident astronomer. He joins us from St. Joseph, Missouri, because he's going to see the totality of the total solar eclipse. And Derek Pitts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
So why St. Joseph, Missouri?
St. Joseph happens to have an airport where the center line of the eclipse passes right over the southwest corner of the airport. So it's a great location. It's not far from Kansas City. That means easy access by air, although I drove out so I could bring equipment. And several friends of mine have identified this location as a great spot, so we're going to view it from there. We'll have 2 minutes and 39 seconds of totality.
And that's, I guess, a lot compared to some other people, including our first guest, Jay Pasikoff. He said he'd get about 2 minutes in Oregon.
Yes, that's true. We have more. We're toward the center of the path of the eclipse across the U.S. So in this location, I'm near greatest duration of the eclipse. That's a little bit further to the east of me, but it's only a few seconds, and that's fine by me. So as it turns out, we're right around the maximum of time availability in the shadow of the moon. This 2 minutes and 40 seconds, though, is not the longest totality can be. That can be a little more than 7 minutes.
Wow.
So we're getting about a quarter of, you know, roughly around a quarter of what we could possibly have for a very long totality duration.
Now, Dave, we're going to be in the Philadelphia area. I assume you are as well. So we're not going to be in totality. How much of the eclipse do you think people in the Philadelphia region will be able to see?
So there's a number of different measures of how much an eclipse is when it's a partial. But roughly about 70-75%, no matter how you slice it.
Still exciting.
Still very exciting, and exciting enough because when you cut that much out of the sun then makes a crescent. And there's something that we are very unaccustomed to, which is normally we've got this big round overhead light, which is the sun, and it casts shadows that you look down at the ground and the shadows look like the thing that they're the shadows of. But when you start, when you have a source that's a crescent shaped, you start getting really weird effects. Yeah. And you can see this through the shadows of the trees, in holes in between the leaves. You can make an effect like this just by crisscrossing your fingers into sort of a waffle shape and making, even without any special equipment at all, just projecting onto the ground. And so there's a lot that you can do that just really weird and unusual, even in a partial eclipse.
But what I hear you saying, Dave, is you can look down and experience some pretty exciting things rather than looking up, obviously, with your specialized eclipse glasses.
Yeah. No, it can't be said enough that you cannot look directly at, right, at a partial eclipse at all. And you should never be looking without special glasses. And regular sunglasses are not going to cut it. We just need to say that right up front.
100 times, just to make sure people don't do that. Derek, I asked Jay Pasikoff the same question, but I'm also interested for those of us here in the Philadelphia area, but those of us in the path of totality. This is going to last over the course of several hours. What does the beginning of an eclipse look like?
The beginning of an eclipse is going to show, as long as you're using your special eclipse glasses to view, or if you're using one of the indirect methods that are available to view this with, you'll begin to see the sun getting smaller as the moon begins to come in from the right-hand edge of the moon, of the sun. And as the moon begins to cover the sun, you'll see that the sun begins to have this crescent shape being taken out of its right-hand side, and that crescent shape grows and grows and grows over time as you move up towards totality. Now, there won't be a tremendous amount of change up through about 85% of the sun getting covered, but after that, you'll begin to see some dramatic changes around you, and you can begin to look for some special kinds of effects as you get within 95% of totality. So we'll begin to look for what are called shadow bands, which are ripples of banding of dark and light across the surface of the ground. And as Dave suggested, you can watch the partial phasing of the sun, of the eclipse, through that sort of waffle shape that he's describing of crossing your fingers, I like to use something called pegboard masonite to show the same sort of thing. And so you'll begin to see the moon covering the surface of the sun. And then as we get right up to totality, of course, there are the various effects like Bailey's beads, the diamond ring effect, and then totality itself.
And does the temperature drop in a noticeable way during those couple of minutes, Derek?
Yeah, the other things that we'll begin to see as we get to within that 95% range is that you'll begin to feel the temperature change as the temperature drops, as the moon is blocking out the light from the sun. But the other really cool thing is that at about 97%, 98%, you can look down the eclipse path, sort of back to where the eclipse is coming from, and you can actually see the shadow of the moon as it's heading towards you. And all around the horizon as you're viewing, you'll be able to see there's sort of a ring of light down close to the horizon as the shadow comes over you and as you're brought into the shadow cone of the moon. So there'll be those kinds of things happening. I'd love to mention something about how animals might behave.
I had a question about that, but no, go ahead, Derek, and I'm sure Dave wants to weigh in on this as well.
Well, I was just going to mention that the only animals I think I'll be observing are going to be the thousands of humans around me as they...
screaming and yelling, right?
Scream with delight, yes, right. So, and I don't think there'll be any animals roosting as if it's night, so we won't get to see that, but we'll have the experience of everybody else around us.
Well, I wonder, I guess because I'm a radio person, Dave, whether the world will sound different for those couple of minutes in totality. Will it be quieter, for instance, besides the screaming people?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, we're so used to sort of artificial events, politics and so on, giving rise to all sorts of activities. I mean, here's something we don't get to schedule. It's just it's happening. Right. You can take it in or you can not take it in. Fortunately, there are going to be a lot of opportunities to be with other people, to experience, you know, something just phenomenal in nature going on around the world as it goes on. But, you know, I don't know that people are going to be quiet about it because you don't have to be. It doesn't change the effect.
Or whether nature gets quiet.
But nature, well, nature actually, nature tends to get a little bit louder in some cases because the animals, you know, the animals actually do respond and chirp. And, I mean, it's
sort of what's going
on
here?
Yeah, it's very different. It's a very different sort of experience for them because here's night coming when their internal clocks are not ready for it.
And in totality, I mean, it really looks like night. I mean, as dark as it gets in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I mean, it dark enough that you're able to see, as Jay was talking about, the corona of the sun itself. I mean, so it's really a million times darker than the sun normally appears in the daytime.
Let me get Jeff from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Jeff, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have him? There we go. Go ahead, Jeff. He's on his way to Kentucky for part of an eclipse project. I'll just say that. Is that you, Jeff? No, we just lost him. I could hear that. Here's an email from Fred. What's the difference between the natural total eclipse and using a round cardboard to hide the sun and still see the corona? Can you take that, Dave?
Yeah, so what the question – I mean, the question is asking about a device called a coronagraph. And the idea – I mean, so Jay discussed a little bit about the sort of structure of the sun. I mean, the sun's got all sorts of nuclear fusion going on in the inside, and it's got a surface called the photosphere. But then outside that are parts of the sun that we normally can't see just because it's too bright. So there's an area outside the photosphere called the chromosphere, and outside of that is this million degree atmosphere that we really don't understand. It's not round; it's all wispy and You know, and there's a great deal of interest in understanding how it works. And so how do you look at it? Well, ideally, you block off the light of the rest of the sun. And we have instruments that are able to do that, but none as effectively – and this is why there are these people studying it – none as effectively and none as completely as during a total solar eclipse.
Wow.
So there really is quite a lot of science you can do at that time.
Let me get John to join our conversation. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning, Marty. What a pleasure. This is a wonderful once-in-a-lifetime experience. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just basically have a comment. We're with the Temple University high-altitude ballooning experiment that's part of the NASA Eclipse Ballooning Project. So there'll be 50 university teams from Portland all the way down to Columbia, South Carolina. We're going to be launching up to 100,000 feet and we'll be live streaming it. So if anybody wants to do it, just Google Eclipse Ballooning Live Stream Project, and they'll be able to check it out.
Oh, that's great.
So that, so this is really an exciting project. The Temple students will be leaving the Space Lab tonight, and we'll be all joining up in Bowling Green on Saturday, Sunday, get tested, and Monday we go up there around 1 o'clock Central Time.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Derek, can you talk a bit about what's going to happen at the Franklin Institute? And Dave, I know there's some things at Drexel University. Derek, go ahead.
We have quite a wide array of activities planned for visitors at the Franklin Institute on Monday. We wanted to make sure that everybody can have a safe, authentic science experience viewing the partial eclipse. So what we've done is we've put together a series of opportunities for people to view both directly and indirectly. So we're going to have a workshop earlier in the day, around beginning at noon, where visitors can create pinhole projection devices that allow you to indirectly view the progress of the eclipse. And this device is a very simple device to make. It's very inexpensive, and it can at least give you an opportunity to see the progress as the moon is moving across the disk of the sun. We'll also have direct methods of viewing using filtered telescopes. You know, we observe the sun at the Franklin Institute through our large refractor on the roof. Any day the sky is clear. We've been doing that for about 80 years now, so we have this method down really well, so that we can filter telescopes so that people will be able to view directly. But we'll also be using what's called eyepiece projection. And that is a method in which you use a telescope, but you project the image onto a projection screen. So a person doesn't have an eye right at the eyepiece in that case. But we'll also have large versions of that as well on something called a sun gun, which is just a refracting telescope with a very large projection screen. We're also going to make what, I don't know exactly how to describe it, something I'm calling a solar tent. So we're going to use the proper solar filtering material, but we're going to build it onto big frameworks so that people can stand underneath this and look up at the sun without having to hold a viewer up to their eye or use another indirect method. And so we'll have a number of these kinds of devices, a really cool thing called a sun spotter, which is a folded refracting telescope that allows you to see an image of the sun projected on a white sheet, and then that way you'll also be able to watch the progress of the moon over the sun.
Dave, you want to tell us what Drexel's going to be doing?
Sure. There are lots of activities going all around the city, all around
say,
the country.
Formal and informal.
Right,
yes.
Right. I mean, so we've got a series of sites that we'll have around campus, basically for students and members of the community to just come on by. So we have an observatory on top of our main building where we'll have a 16-inch telescope with a Mylar solar filter that people will be able to look directly through. But I think, quite frankly, I think that the even more interesting show is we'll be out on our main quad, and we'll have some pinhole cameras and loner glasses as well. But the main event will be a hydrogen alpha filter on our solar telescope, so you can see sunspots and features. I mean, we're at solar minimum right now, so it's not – we're very near solar minimum, so there's not a lot of detail. But it will be a really exciting opportunity to actually see the eclipse sort of as it's happening up close.
And there must be something about experiencing this in a group that just makes it feel more exciting.
Yes, absolutely. And in a group, and also with your own eyes. I mean, you know, when you think about the last time an eclipse went across the continental U.S., that was 1918.
99 years ago.
When you think about the technology that's come about since then, the fact that we're now able to project things over computers and we're able to see things with higher resolution than we ever could with our naked eye, you might think for a moment, well, but why would you want to see it with your naked eye then? Or why would you want to see it just looking through the telescope? But the experience of seeing an eclipse, or, you know, while we're on the topic, seeing planets, even, you know, through these telescopes with your own eyes, it brings you, in my mind, much, much closer to this sort of authentic experience, the real experience of being out there in space.
Here's an email.
Hey, Marty,
go ahead, Derek.
Can I just echo what Dave was saying?
Absolutely.
On that? Because he's reminded me that, you know, we have a rooftop observatory also, and we have a fifth-floor roof deck where we often do nighttime observing. But for this event in particular, we've moved everything outside to the Winter Street side of the building, where we've closed off that Winter Street section so that we can have our visitors out in that area, that so that they can experience this as a group. Right. And that's really the way we want this to be done, and that's why we're not opening our observatory for viewing. We want to reduce the idea that this is a singular experience where one person looks through the eyepiece of the telescope, you know, by themselves kind of thing. And the other piece of it is that I always think of observational astronomy like this as an interactive experience. And it's interactive in the sense that when you're observing it yourself directly, the photons coming from that astronomical object strike your retina. So it's an interactive experience, whether it's observing a solar eclipse using the proper viewing equipment, or if you're outside under the night sky using a telescope to observe distant objects somewhere else around the galaxy or universe. So that authenticity that Dave speaks of also sort of blends over into interactivity as well.
That is Derek Pitts, a very familiar voice here at WHYY, our resident astronomer. He's chief astronomer and a planetarium director at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. He's joining us from St. Joseph, Missouri. He is there to see totality, the total solar eclipse. He'll see about 2 minutes and 40 seconds of a total eclipse. Dave Goldberg with us here in our Philadelphia studio. We'll be seeing about 75%, maybe 80% of a total eclipse.
75%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's a professor of physics, associate dean at Drexel University's College of Arts and Sciences, also an astrophysicist, author of The User's Guide to the Universe and The Universe in the Rearview Mirror. We are talking about Monday's solar eclipse. And you can join our conversation, any questions or comments, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break, including a bunch of comments about literally how to look at the partial eclipse. And I do want to address that after this short break. We'll be right back.
The only way to beat poison ivy, the beneficial insects in your backyard, the wasp without which you could not get figs, and the most important fall pruning advice you'll ever hear. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll talk good bugs, bad ivy, and much more. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday at 7 a.m. and again at noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
Presby's Inspired Life supports WHYY. For 62 years, this nonprofit has provided exceptional living to people 62 and better across Greater Philadelphia and is proud of its more than 30 communities. Learn more about Presby and its inspiring mission to serve people across Greater Philadelphia at presbysinspiredlife.org. Presby's Inspired Life. Exceptional without exception. Information on the new planned cottage expansion, Rydal Waters at Rydal Park, is also available online at rydalwaters.org.
Let me read a couple of comments here, and I want to take care of all of them. I see some calls as well. One from John: I've stared at thousands of sunsets with no eye damage. Is there a difference looking at the eclipse? A comment from Carol: I have a pair of old glasses with blue lenses. Is that safe to wear? A question from Bill: are there substitutes to watch it other than glasses? Something we touched on. How can we verify eclipse glasses that the people are selling are safe? And I wonder if I can toss this first to you, Dave. Obviously, none of us are ophthalmologists here, but the word is you need safe glasses that pass this kind of a test, and you do not want to look directly at a partial eclipse.
No, you do not. I mean, so in Philadelphia, with 25% even at max, 25% of the light coming in even at maximum, it would be painful. Your body would tell
don't
you not
do
to
it.
Do it.
Do
right.
not do it.
But don't do it. And in fact, it isn't even just like, are these glasses good enough? There's a rating, and I'll read it off just so you realize it's ISO 12312-2. And if your glasses are not rated that, don't use them. So old glasses aren't going to do the trick. you know, there are other indirect ways to look at the eclipse.
In fact, that I mean, we touched on a number of them, including that the old-fashioned, I guess, boxes that you can create and make the pinhole.
Pinhole projectors are wonderful ways to look at the eclipse.
Derek, anything you want to add? I just want to reiterate, do not use those old blue glasses you found in the bottom drawer. You need very specialized glasses. Derek, anything you want to add to this?
Polarized glasses won't do it for you either. You can't use multiple pairs of sunglasses. None of those things will work for you. As Dave said, you need that very, very special ISO-certified viewing material in order to be totally safe on this. Unfortunately, this material had been, up until recently, relatively easy to get a hold of. And so, you know, with the rush on, I think the supplies have become very, very thin these days for eclipse glasses. So perhaps one of the other indirect methods will work for you. And in fact, there are a number of household items that will give you this indirect crescent view of the progress of the eclipse. One of my favorite being a utensil from your kitchen, a colander, will work really, really well.
Oh, cool.
All the little holes that you find in a colander, not the slit sort of colander, but the little holes, those all act as pinhole projectors and so can project multiple images of the progress of the eclipse.
Let me get Richard from Mount Laurel, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. I have a very simple question that I haven't found the answer to, which is, if the moon rises in the east and sets in the west based on the Earth's rotation, how is it that the eclipse is moving from west to east?
That was a question I put to our guest, Dave, before we began the show. Dave, you want to start? And Derek, I'm sure you'd like to weigh in. Why is this happening west to east?
So it is difficult to picture, especially on the radio, sort of the motions of three different objects in three dimensions. But the way you can think about it is how the shadow, if you've got something that's moving from west to east, or east to west, rather, how the shadow is going to project itself, right? And so the issue is that the shadow is going to effectively move in that opposite direction. But again, you have to sort of try to picture those three objects in sort of three dimensions. It's not easy, even if you've been thinking about it for a while.
And of course, those three objects, Derek, are the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon. Anything you want to add to that? Why is it going west to east?
Well, the only thing I can add to that is that if you were to get yourself up off the surface of the Earth, that would help you to see what's actually happening. Because, you know, here on the Earth, we have this geocentric view of how things look like they're happening, this apparent motion. Like, you know, it appears that the sun is rising in the morning or the moon is rising in the evening, when really it's the Earth rotating from west to east, looking at what seems to be a static point in a sense of, you know, that allows it to seem as if that's happening. But if you could be up off the surface of the Earth and have a heliocentric view, as if you're at the sun looking in this direction,
right,
then you can actually see a little bit better how it is that the shadow of the moon is zipping across the face of the planet. And in fact, it is that the moon's motion in its orbit is so much faster that you can actually see how the moon makes this very, very quick pass, relatively speaking, across the United States, in contrast to what you seem to see when you watch the sun rise or the moon rise on the eastern horizon.
I have in big letters here, but what about fake glasses? They did not answer it. And I just have to say, Derek is an astronomer. Dave is an astrophysicist. I mean, I would call your eye doctor. I would call a professional within the ophthalmology interest to get an answer to that.
Sure. And the other thing is, I will say that a lot of retailers have taken the eclipse very seriously. I know that Amazon, for example, to give one name, they have, I think, ahead of time basically identified sellers that are trusted to have ISO compliant glasses. So,
but chances are you're not going to get them by Monday.
Chances are you're going to have to pay a mint if you are.
Yes, that's about right. And the other thing is that NASA has also done a very good job of identifying reputable retailers, but they've also identified three specific manufacturers of material that they believe that they trust as being the proper material to use in glasses. And so those, again, will be difficult to find at this point. Out here where I am, there are a number of places in Kansas City that are giving glasses away. They've held on to them until this point, and now they're just beginning to distribute these certified glasses in various places. So not recommending anybody come out to Kansas City just to get the glasses, but maybe if you dig around, you might still be able to find some somewhere around the Delaware Valley.
Let me see what Ingrid has to say. She's calling us from Philadelphia. Ingrid, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Meredy. Thank you. You have such a knowledgeable panel there.
Yes, we do.
My question is for Dr. Goldberg. I was wondering, could he elaborate a little bit more on the things that he would be observing on the planet as the eclipse is taking place? He said that that, you know, some scientists would be looking down. I'm wondering, are you going to be looking down at insects, plant life, bodies of water?
Just how many changes would be observable that way?
So that's really interesting. So, I mean, I was thinking more in terms of being an amateur astronomer. And again, a lot of these effects, a lot of the most pronounced effects are going to be in the path of totality. But one of the reasons you can look down is you can see these interesting shadows and you can see other optical effects. But I mean, I do want to address the fact that there's a lot of really interesting science, some of which we already talked about, looking at the corona of the sun, for example, and being able to look at the corona of the sun sort of at different times and see how it changes. But you know, there's all sorts of like modern technology that we're looking at now. So one of the cool things I heard about was were solar panels, new technology that people are using. And so all of a sudden we're gonna turn these solar panels, essentially turn all the access, the light off to them. And then the question is, even for a couple of minutes. And then the question is, how do the redistribution networks deal with this effect? So there's an awful lot of things that you wouldn't even necessarily think about as being science that you can do, but there's astronomy, there's straight physics. We talked about the magnetic fields before. You can see how the animals respond. You can see how our power grids respond. So there's a lot going on in terms of scientific discovery for an event like this.
Derek, are there specific things that you want to understand from this totality?
Of course, I'm always interested in understanding more about the magnetic field of the sun, as we can determine, as the corona can help us understand a bit more about that. Of course, the interest in the corona itself, about its heating, and how it can manage to get to such extreme temperatures. I'm particularly interested in this. This is my own particular interest, is the shadow bands on the ground that appear just before and just after totality. It's not clearly understood exactly what causes them, other than to say that it's understood that it's an atmospheric event and is generally related to cells of different temperature air. But they don't always appear. A lot depends on what the atmospheric conditions are at the time. They can be elusive and hard to capture, but I'm interested in seeing those.
Derek, you're going to be in the path of totality. Are the stars going to come out during that couple of minutes?
I'm hoping that we'll have clear enough sky so that we'll be able to see some adjacent bright stars not far from the sun. But we'll also be looking for bright planets also. Venus will be the primary one to look for, as it'll be the brightest one that stands out. And it doesn't get very far from the sun. Same is true for Mercury. So we'll be looking for that as well. Along with the corona, of course, that'll be the star of the show in a sense. So we'll look for that too.
And have you checked the weather forecast for Monday?
I'm checking the weather forecast every 10 minutes.
Even during Radio Times, right?
I'm online right now.
Okay, so what do you see?
And right now, you know, we're 3 days out, and this is always a challenge. Right now, it looks as if there's some chance of clouds and perhaps some showers in the morning, with some slight improvement through mid-eclipse time and improving later on. And right now, you know, we'll see how things turn out, but it's about 50-50 at the moment.
Dave, you wanted to add something earlier.
Yeah, I did. So you asked about the visibility of stars, and we just talking about the science that one can do during an eclipse, and I just wanted to sort of relay a very, very important finding from almost a century ago, from just after the last total eclipse in the U.S., or continental U.S. So Einstein, we've all heard of him, came up with his famous theory of general relativity, and one of the predictions was that the light of stars would be bent around massive bodies like the sun, which has the effect of basically shifting their position in the sky. Not by very much, but you can measure it, and you could measure it a century ago. And so Einstein came up with this theory. But the problem is the only thing big enough nearby to bend the light is the sun, and normally you can't see the stars because the sun is out, except during a total eclipse. So unfortunately, cloud conditions in the 1918 eclipse didn't do it. But in 1919, Sir Arthur Eddington went to West Africa. He was able to observe it. He was able to confirm Einstein's theory. I mean, it was incredible. And the thing that makes it most incredible is this is just following World War I, when you had the Germans on one side and the English on the other. And here was this English this English scientist confirming a theory of a German scientist. So it was a really good time, I think, to sort of bring the world back together.
Absolutely. Let me see what Pam from Cherry Hill has to say. Pam, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Good show.
Thanks.
I'm going to Charleston, South Carolina with my husband and 10-year-old son. And I pulled this trip together within the last month. I can't believe I was able to find a hotel room.
Good for you.
But and my question is this. So I have the eclipse glasses. I'm all ready to rock and roll. But I was wondering, like, there's a couple of different events in Charleston to see. I mean, there's a children's museum. There's a Charleston astronomy meetup that's a public viewing. There's even a baseball game, I guess,
An eclipse baseball game?
An eclipse baseball game, that's right. Or should I just, like, go out in the field and look? What's the best to do?
Well, what do you think, Dave?
I would definitely spend the 2 minutes during the totality looking at the sky. Don't worry about the rest of it. I mean, of course, you know, you've got a couple of hours between what's called first contact and fourth contact, between when it begins and ends. But I mean, I think to me, if I were there, if I were able to arrange a trip like that, I would be focused on a nice open sky, maybe some good friends around me, and just looking at the sky and sort of enjoying it. And
because totality will be in Charleston, as I looked at the map.
Yes.
Derek, I read that you, I don't know if you planned your honeymoon around an eclipse, but I read that there was some connection there. Yes?
Yes, that was the 1999 total solar eclipse in August. My wife and I had been married 2 years before, and what we did was we planned our honeymoon to coincide with that solar eclipse. And so we planned a cruise in Europe that would take us up through the Black Sea during the eclipse, and it would be a perfect location. The way it turned out, though, was that another group of astronomers were also on board the ship for the solar eclipse.
Yep.
And the captain was not aware that there was a solar eclipse happening on the cruise, but when he found out, he called all of us up to the bridge and said, "We need somebody to lead us on this eclipse trip." And I stood there and I looked over my shoulder and recognized that everybody had taken one step back, and so I was in the hot seat for that. And it worked out very well. I told the captain where to take the ship, when to put it there, and he said, "When we get it there, we'll turn it over to you. You'll have it for the eclipse. When the eclipse is done, I'll take control back, and we'll head on to the next destination."
Well, Derek,
it worked out fabulously.
That's a great way to end the show. Derek Pitts, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And Dave Goldberg, thank you for coming in and joining us as well.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you.
And we have been talking about Monday's solar eclipse. And Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri, with help from Susan Greenbaum today. I'm Marty Moscoane. We close things out with Bill Withers, "Ain't No Sunshine When She's Gone," released in 1971.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away. And I know. Hey, I ought to leave the young thing alone, but ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone.